These guys here give me ones, but because 1 and 0 have no overlap, these terms cancel, and I'm just left with two terms in the reduced density operator for S, this guy and this guy. So the point is that if you have a pair of systems, A and S, and suppose they start in a product state like this. So S is a coherent superposition of the 0 and 1 states. And A is just completely uncorrelated. So if I calculate the density operator for this guy, I just take the outer product of this with itself, and I trace over A, I'll just get a 1 here, and I'll just be left with the projector onto this vector. So in this case, the reduced density operator for S is just whatever the state of S is here. Right? It's not mixed, it's pure. But if you allow these guys to interact in such a way that they become entangled, so you can think of this evolution here as system A is essentially doing a measurement of whether S is 0 or 1, because the final state of A will tell you whether S is 0 or 1. And then if you calculate the reduction of the final state, oh, that's what we did up here, and you compare the reduced state on S of the initial guy and the final guy, you see that initially it's this projector onto the coherent superposition, so it has off-diagonal terms, it has coherence in this basis, but it evolves to something that has no coherence in that basis. And so this is what people sometimes call decoherence. If you have a system like A that gains some information about another system S in this sort of way, that it becomes entangled with it, then you lose coherence between the different states for S. Okay, so that's an idea that comes up a lot, and it's sort of important for you to understand how just coupling to something else and becoming entangled with it will lead to a loss of coherence for the system of interest. So if you go to S after this interaction has happened, and you measure, for example, you know, this a basis that has this as one of its eigenstates, you'll find non-deterministic results, right? You'll sometimes get A0 plus B1, sometimes get the orthogonal state. Whereas if you do the measurement here, you'll always get the A0 plus B1 result. Anyhow, so I thought I would just review that because it's critical. Okay, so this was the where I ended last time, and you should recognize this from your tutorial yesterday if you're doing it, that a density operator is an operator that is both positive, so that means its expectation value for all states in the Hilbert space is positive, and it has unit trace, which is the normalization condition. And if you have an operator that satisfies that, then it turns out you can always find an ensemble, so a set of probabilities and a set of pure states, that average to that operator, whatever it is. And you can always find a pure state on a system and ancilla. So the ancilla is that second system. It could just be another copy of the system you're interested in. You can always find a pure state on that pair of copies such that the reduced density operator on the system is rho, the operator you started with. So in other words, every mixed state and pure state admits of some convex decomposition into pure states and some purification into an entangled state on a larger system. And in fact, and this is the interesting thing, there are many convex decompositions that average to a given density operator, and there are many purifications of a given density operator. It's not unique. So let me tell you about that non-uniqueness, because it will also come up later in the course. So take this example. Here's a density operator, identity over 2, it's mixed. If you remember the block ball, it's the point at the very center of the block ball. And in terms of spin eigenstates, turns out you can decompose it as an equal mixture of Z spin eigenstates up and down, but you can also decompose it as an equal mixture of X spin eigenstates up and down. And just to convince you of that, if I write these all out as matrices, so this is the identity matrix, this is in the Z eigenstate basis, this is the Z spin up state, this is the Z spin down state, I'm taking the outer product here. And similarly, sorry, they're both Z spin up, this is the column vector that represents the ket, this is the row vector that represents the bra. This is the Z spin down state. And similarly, here are the x spin up states and the x spin down states. So if I multiply these out, these are the matrices I get. And sure enough, you can verify easily that these equations hold. So it's clear that this equation I wrote down originally is valid. I can decompose the Kliuba mixed state in these two different ways. If you look at that in the Bloch sphere, it corresponds to the fact that, you know, here are my z spin eigenstates, here are my x spin eigenstates. In the first tutorial, you saw that all the states on the line between them can be obtained as mixtures of these two guys. And the equal mixture is the point at the center. And similarly here. And so there is a point where these two lines intersect, and that means that's the completely mixed state. So I can decompose it in these two different ways. OK, so a couple of comments about that. First of all, it poses a bit of a problem for a certain naive interpretation of mixed states. So suppose you have an entangled state, and you calculate the reduced density operator on one of the sides, and you find it's this, identity over 2. And then you say, well, I'm going to try to interpret that as it's really a z spin up eigenstate with probability half, or a z spin down eigenstate with probability half. And, you know, because you can decompose it this way, you think that seems like a pretty good interpretation. But then you note that you can also decompose it this way, and that would suggest a different interpretation, that it's probability half this guy and probability half that guy. The fact that there's this non-uniqueness makes it questionable to interpret it as a mixture for any given one of these ensembles. There isn't a preferred ensemble into which you could interpret the completely mixed state as being a mixture for that ensemble. Okay, so that's the first comment. The second comment is that this fact that there are states which can be decomposed in many different ways, as we see here, is really important for trying to distinguish quantum theory from classical theories and from other operational theories. So when we get to the axiomatization stuff, probably tomorrow, you'll see that feature of quantum mechanics features into the axiomatic scheme. If I'll tell you about how a classical theory looks, and in a classical theory, a mixed state has a unique decomposition into pure states, and so it's very different from quantum mechanics. More generally, the shape of this space of states, so in quantum mechanics it's a ball, characterizes quantum theory. If we're doing a classical theory, we'll see that the shape of that space of states is a simplex, not a ball. And so people who try to axiomatize quantum theory have been focused on trying to explain the shape of the convex set of states. OK, so all of that is about the multiplicity of ways of decomposing a mixed state into a pure state ensemble. I also said that there's many ways of purifying it to an entangled state. So again, let's take one half identity on some system S as our mixed state. I'm just giving a simple example of two entangled states on a larger system, SA, that both have this as their reduced state on S. So in this case, it's an entangled state between Z spin eigenstates. And if you go and take the trace over A, you'll be able to verify that it's a complete mixed state. And here, it's an entangled state between the eigenstates of Z and the eigenstates of X. So it's a different state, but they both have the same reduction. OK, this sort of feature you're going to see is generic, that for a given object in the general formalism, if it admits of decompositions, purifications, ways of understanding it, typically you'll find that there are many ways of doing that, many ways of decomposing it. So that we'll see more examples of this. And that's it for the general scheme of preparations, or the general types of preparations. So now I want to talk about what the most general representation of a measurement is in the formalism. So I've updated this column here to a density operator. So far we've been focused on these kinds of measurements. Of a Hermitian operator, but as we talked about last time, really all you care about are the projectors in the spectral resolution of that Hermitian operator, and the eigenvalues are irrelevant. So it's better to say that the measurement's associated with one of these projection-valued measures. And the question is there anything more general than that? So what I'll try to convince you of is that there is, and it goes by the name of a positive operator-valued measure, POVM. So I'll represent those by EKs. K here again labels the outcome of the measurement. And the Born rule will look very much the same. It'll just be trace rho EK. So here's the difference summarized. This is your standard measurement with projections. This is a POVM. In both cases, the operators are positive for all outcomes. In both cases, they're going to sum to identity. In both cases, the Born rule is going to look like this. And the main difference is that the POVM is not going to have to satisfy a condition of orthogonality among that the projections satisfy. But I thought it'd be useful maybe to tell you where these various conditions come from. So suppose you grant that the probability of outcome K is trace rho EK. Okay, so let's say you take the Born rule. Then you know that, so this is supposed to be interpreted as the probability of getting outcome K. If that's going to be positive for all states, right? So no matter what state you feed into the measurement device, you expect to get some positive probability for outcome K, or at least non-negative. Then, you know, just using the equation, it has to be that trace rho EK is positive for all rho. And in particular, if I take the pure states, it should be positive. So if I take trace of projector onto psi, this should be positive for all psi in the Hilbert space. Let me know if this gets too low. Right, and then remember the identity involving the trace operation. I can turn this into just the expectation value of EK for psi. And this is just the definition of positivity, right? That's what I wrote here. That's what it is for EK to be a positive operator. So that's why these guys should be positive. And then secondly, if this is going to be a probability distribution, it had better be that when I sum over K those probabilities, I get 1. Because some outcome has to happen. And again, that should be true for all states. And then that implies, again, just plug using that formula, that the sum over K of trace rho EK should be 1 for all rho. And again, I can do it just for the pure states. And what I get is, so I'll move this sum over K inside the trace. So it'll be this. It'll be psi of sum over K EK psi equal to 1 for all states in the Hilbert space. And the only way to have this, if I say I've got an operator and its expectation value for all states in the Hilbert space is 1, then you know that that operator has to be the identity operator. So this is the unit trace condition. And this is the positivity condition. That's where they come from. And then finally, if I demand that these positive operators be not just positive, but also projections. So there I'm saying, if the EKs are actually pi Ks and they're idempotent, so they square to themselves, or equivalently, you could say, you know, they only have eigenvalues 0 or 1. Then it's straightforward to show that the different elements, so, you know, if I set I equal to j, this is just pi squared equal to pi. But if I have different elements in the POVM, they have to be orthogonal, so their product has to be 0. So that's the only sense in which standard measurements differ from these more general measurements. They have to be orthogonal. Questions about that? So I haven't told you, you know, why we have to use these more general measurements. So far, I've just sort of given you the definition of what a POVM is. So instead of always saying positive operator valued measure, I'll just say POVM. Yes?
Does that mean we don't have any... That means if we repeat our measurement, then we don't get the synchronization. That means we don't have eigenstates for that kind of.
That's right. In general, with POVMs, it's not the case that if I do the measurement a second time, I get the same result. So that's going to be a feature that's unique to these kinds of measurements, not these. And furthermore, you don't necessarily, so whereas with a projection valued measure, you could say for every outcome, you can find a state which makes that outcome certain to occur. With POVMs, that's not necessarily the case. And what we're going to see is that these are necessary for describing noisy measurements. So measurements where you don't have perfect predictability of the outcome, you need to move to these sorts of objects rather than using the other ones. All right, so let me give you the first and simplest example of a scenario where you would need a POVM and a projection valued measure is insufficient. And it's very similar to the first example I gave for motivating a density operator. It's just a case where you're going to choose which measurement to do at random. So again, this I have, say, three different measurement devices. I'm going to assume they all have the same number of outcomes, which are labeled by k. And I imagine that which measurement is done is just chosen at random by throwing some dice. And the whole thing is inside a black box. And so the person on the outside just learns what outcome occurred. So imagine a circuit that reports the outcome of whichever of these measurements was done and sends it out of the box. But the person outside the box doesn't find out how the dice came up. So the person outside the box doesn't know which of these three measurements was done. And the question is, how should they represent the entire box in the formalism if they just want to calculate what are the probabilities of the various different outcomes that might occur? So again, it's just you start with probability theory. You say, well, the probability of outcome k is going to be the probability of getting outcome k given that you did measurement I times the probability that you did measurement I, summed over I. And we know what the probability of getting outcome k given that you did measurement I is. The preparation is just of some state rho, so it's trace pi k I rho. So this is the kth projector for the set of projectors that represent the ith measurement here. And the probability of I is just, you know, whatever this distribution defined by the dice is. So that's the expression for the overall probability of getting outcome k. And then I just do the standard tricks where I move the pi into the trace and I move the sum into the trace and I group them all together. And now this looks like trace of some operator times rho. So I just call that operator EKS. It's clearly an operator on the system Hilbert space because it's built out of just these projections, which are on the system Hilbert space. And so I now know I can represent this entire box by this set of projectors for the different values of k. And then you can prove that this set of projectors I've just defined does satisfy the mathematical definition of a positive operator valued measure. So if I take this object here and I ask, is its expectation value positive for all states? Well, the expectation value comes inside the sum. Its expectation values of projectors, those are always positive. They're summed together with positive weights, so it's positive. So yes, this holds. And the second thing you need to check is, do they sum to identity when I sum over k? So again, if I sum this guy over k, I switch the order of the summation. Now I'm summing the pi k's for a given value of I. Well, that was a projection valued measure. So for every value of I, when I sum over k, I get identity. So this just goes to identity. Sum over I pi is 1, so the whole thing's identity. So yes, it satisfies that definition as well. So this shows you that, you know, if you want to be able to describe these kinds of measurements, and from the operationalist perspective, this is just as good a measurement as anything else. It's, you know, a box that you feed in a quantum system and it generates a classical outcome, so it meets the definition of a measurement. If you want to be able to model it using the Born rule, then you have to go beyond just these projection valued measures. You need to use these more general things. Is that clear? Okay, let's move to a second example. Or actually, no, let's first do a couple of examples of some specific examples of this kind of mixture of different measurements. So here, I'm taking just two different measurements. which I'm using quantum information notation here. So, you know, thus far I've been talking about Z spin and X spin eigenstates, but quantum information theorists like to just use a simpler notation where this sort of measurement is just represented as 0 versus 1, and the X eigenstates are just represented as plus and minus. Because you can always just write these states as 0 plus or minus 1 over root 2. So maybe you saw this sort of notation in Adrian's course or some other course. So those are the two measurements I'm going to consider. And I'm going to imagine that they're chosen at random with probability a half each. And the question is, what's the POVM for the whole box? So it's simple. You're just averaging the first outcome here with the first outcome here with probabilities a half each. That's what the prescription here tells us to do. Take the projector for the kth outcome and sum it over all the different measurements with their prior. So here it's just, you know, here's the first outcome for each of these measurements summed up with their prior probabilities. So I'll call that operator E1. Here's the second outcome, that's E2. And if I wanted to, I could draw these in the block sphere. So this is just one plane of the block sphere. So I'm imagining, you know, these are Z eigenstates and these are X eigenstates. The 0, 1, plus and minus states are here, 0, 1, plus, minus. So the mixture of 0 and plus is this point here. The mixture of 1 and minus is this point. So you can sort of think of this POVM as having a pair of elements here and here. If it had been these two points, then that would have been a projection-valued measure, you know, because I'd be on the surface, and so those would be projectors onto pure states. And it would be basically a measurement of spin along this axis, an axis between z and x. But the fact that it's closer to the middle means that it's basically a noisy version of that measurement. And so, for example, if I prepare a state here, if that's the row that I feed into this device, I'm not always going to get the first outcome. Sometimes I'll get the second outcome because, well, let's do the calculation. So suppose row, here's a different example. So let's say I put this row into the box, just the zero state. If I want to know what's the probability of getting the first outcome, I just take trace row E1. If I take this times this, and I trace, I just get a half overlap of 0 with itself, a half overlap of 0 with plus. This is 1, this is a half, so it's 3/4. So if I prepare this state and I do this measurement, I get this outcome with 3/4, this outcome with 1/4. If I did another example where the state was this one here, you'd find that it gets this first outcome with high probability, this second outcome with low probability. But there is no state in the Hilbert space that always gives the first outcome. So in that sense, it's an intrinsically noisy measurement. There's nothing you can do that'll make the outcome of this measurement perfectly predictable. Is that clear? Okay, here's another example. I mixed the 0-1 measurement with this funny measurement. So identity over 2, identity over 2, that's a pair of operators. They're each positive. If I sum them, I get identity. So it satisfies the mathematical definition of a POVM. How should I interpret it, just this guy by itself? How would, you know, what does that correspond to, that POVM? Complete noise. Yes. So if I take an arbitrary state rho, and I ask what's the probability of getting the first outcome of that POVM, it's just trace of rho times identity over 2. That's trace of rho is always 1. So this is a half for all rho. So it says it doesn't matter what state you feed into this POVM. It's always going to give you a probability half for the first outcome, and it's going to give you a probability half for the second outcome. So basically, a measurement that ignores the system entirely and flips a fair coin will implement the POVM identity over 2, identity over 2. So it might seem strange to call that a measurement, But remember, all we're saying in this operational approach is a measurement is something where you feed in a quantum system and you get a classical output. And so if inside the box, you know, the system is thrown in the trash and a coin is flipped and the outcome is presented to you, well, that fits the definition of a measurement. So we need a way of representing it. So we represent it with this POVM here. So this bigger box here that I've described
is now basically, you know, you can think of it as with probability Q, do the measurement you're interested in. With probability 1 minus Q, flip a coin. So in a way, this is a model of noise that, you know, in reality, what might happen when you do a measurement is the outcome could, with some small probability, have nothing to do with the system you fed in and just be some, you know, random noise that your detector has picked up. So you could think of this as a simple model of noise in your detector. And if you ask what's the effective POVM for the whole box, what you find is, again, all you have to do is say weight this positive operator with its prior Q, weight this guy with its prior. So this is what the first element of the POVM looks like. And if I diagonalize this, I get just 1 plus Q over 2, 0, plus 1 minus Q over 2, 1. And if I draw that on the block sphere, again, it's a point that's not all the way up at the zero state. It's between the zero state and the completely mixed state at the center. So you could think of this as a noisy version of a spin measurement along the z-axis. Again, here, if I feed in a z-spin-up eigenstate, the zero state here, and I calculate what's the probability of getting the first outcome, well, it's just trace of rho times this operator. It's orthogonal to this piece. It gives me 1 here, so it's just 1 plus q over 2. So if q is very close to 1, this probability is very close to 1. It says that, you know, you're going to be able to have a high degree of predictability that when you feed in the state, you're very likely to get the first outcome. But the closer q gets to 0, the less of the time you're actually doing this measurement, the more of the time you're actually just flipping a coin. And this POVM gets closer and closer to being just identity over 2, identity over 2, where both points would converge at the center, which is just this measurement here. Okay, so that hopefully that motivates why we need POVMs if we're going to describe these kinds of noise. But there's another example where you need a POVM, which is in some ways even more interesting. So here's another measurement I could do. It takes the system of interest. It takes another system, which I'll call the ancilla, labeled by A, prepares. You imagine preparing that system in some particular way, and then doing a joint measurement on the pair of them, S and A. So that means you could bring them together, do some unitary, and then project onto one of them. Or you could just think of this as some overall measurement of a basis on the Hilbert's tensor product of the Hilbert spaces, for example. Okay, so we could just have some set of projectors on that larger Hilbert space, which describes that measurement, and the outcomes are labeled by K. And so suppose all of this is inside a box, and out of the box comes the outcome K. And the question is, how should I model this as a set of operators on the Hilbert space of the system alone? Right now, the measurement is on the Hilbert space of the system and the ancilla. But I would like to model the entire box as a measurement on the system alone. So again, this is a perfectly valid measurement. It fits the description of you feed in a system on S, and you get out a classical output. Well, so we just have to do the math. So if I conceptualize the experiment in a different way, if I think of it as a preparation of S and A, then the state for S and A is just rho S tensor tau A. It's just a product. And then I'm doing this measurement here, measuring the pi k's, and I'm just using the Born rule. So I'm tracing over the whole Hilbert space, the measurement on the whole Hilbert space times the state on the whole Hilbert space. Okay, and then I can factorize this trace into a trace over S and a trace over A. And I can factorize this guy here, rho S tensor tau A, into rho S tensor identity on A times identity on S tensor tau on A. They commute, right, because they're acting on different Hilbert spaces. And so I can lump the tau together with the pi. I can put them here. I could have written this as identity on S tensor tau on A if I wanted to multiply it with him. It's just a shorthand notation. And so the trace over A, all the things that depend on A are here. So I can take the trace over A of this And as I mentioned last time, if you've got an operator on S tensor A and you trace over A, you're left with an operator on S. So this is an operator on S. That's what I wanted. I now have, again, the familiar form of the Born rule, trace of some operator on S times rho S. And so this is going to be the POVM that describes this whole box here. So again, I have to prove to you that it satisfies all the properties of a POVM. So again, it's not hard to do if you take this and you test whether it's the case that the expectation value for all states on S is positive, you find that's true. And if you sum over K of this guy, well, move the sum over K on the inside. These guys are going to sum to identity on the whole Hilbert space. But now I'm going to trace over A, tau A. That's just one. I'm left with identity on S. I won't do the calculation at length. But yeah, you can easily verify that those conditions hold. So again, it's represented by a POVM.
I have a question.
Yes.
What's an
ancilla? So an ancilla is just an auxiliary system that you use to make your measurement. It comes from the Greek, I think. It means originally handmade. And I think it was brought up in, started to be used in computer science as an ancillary system, something that you use to do what you're interested in doing. So I got it right, Sarah?
I mean, it's from the handmade thing, it's like a helping system.
That's it. So it turns out that there are certain POVMs that you can only implement in this way. You can't implement them as mixtures of projections. And so in that sense, you know, you sometimes sort of need the helping hand of another system. Strictly speaking, that's not true. There are other ways of doing it. I could just imagine this system to be embedded in a larger Hilbert space. But yeah, when I say ancilla, I just mean a second system that's helping you to make your measurement. Okay, so I'll do an example of this one as well. So I'm going to imagine both the system and the ancilla are qubits. And I'm going to imagine that the ancilla is prepared in this particular coherent superposition of 0 and 1 with some parameter theta describing the weights. And then I'm going to do this fancy measurement on the pair of them. So this is the Bell basis for the pair of qubits. Have you seen this before? Yes? Okay, right. Good. I knew that. So it's not hard to verify that this is indeed a basis, right? It's a four-dimensional Hilbert space for two qubits, and these guys are all orthogonal to one another. So I can think of it as a measurement. And it's exactly the measurement that you do in the teleportation protocol, as you saw yesterday. And so the question is, if you prepare the ancilla in this way and do this measurement, what's the effective measurement on the system? What's the POVM that this describes? So first of all, note that to make the connection with what we had on the previous slide, I should write down the density operator associated with this guy. So that's just the projector onto theta A. And I should come up with the projectors for each of these guys. So that's just the outer product of each one of these with itself. And then what we saw on the previous slide was that the positive operators are just the trace over A, these projectors times the state on A. So I can plug in these values, and it just ends up being the projector onto SA sandwiched between these theta A states. But remember, by the definition of the partial inner product, this whole thing leaves me with an operator on S, because I'm only sandwiching between a state on A, and so I have an S degree of freedom left over. So when you work it out, you get this, that this state on S here, this vector on S, is a particular coherent superposition of 0 and 1 with these weights. So it's like this guy, but I might have a minus sign here, depending on whether I've started with k equal to 1 or k is equal to 2. And if I do k is equal to 3 or k is equal to 4, I get just sine theta over 2 here and cos theta over 2 here. And so I can think of these as four states on the block disk, for the block disk containing the z and x eigenstates. And they look like these four points here. So
theta minus theta, pi minus theta, and pi plus theta. Here I've drawn the case of theta equal to pi by 4. And so when I calculate these four operators, I get these four guys. So they're not quite projections, because each of them is multiplied by a scalar. But it's not hard to verify that because, you know, theta and pi plus theta are orthogonal states, that if I sum these two guys, I get an identity. So these two terms sum to identity over 2. These two terms sum to identity over 2. So the four terms sum to identity. So it does satisfy the definition of a POVM. And so it's one of these measurements such that there is no preparation that will make its outcome determined. It'll always be a probabilistic outcome. And the probabilities will be determined by the overlaps with these four states. This is sometimes called the BB84 POVM. And I'm not going to tell you why. I don't know why I told you that. Okay. So questions about POVMs so far? Clear? Good. So I'm curious whether there's any place where you've encountered a measurement in quantum theory that you've thought, how do you represent this by a projection or a Hermitian operator? Has this ever happened to any of you? Or there's some measurement that doesn't look like it should be associated with a Hermitian operator at all? No? Well, I'll give you an example that troubled me once. And so I was very happy to find out about POVMs because it resolved this problem. So if you look at a von Neumann model of a measurement, like in von Neumann's textbook, suppose I want to measure an operator A on a system. Well, von Neumann says, look, take another system, call it the probe, and write down a Hamiltonian that has an interaction term, A tensor momentum for that system. And because momentum generates translations, if you then measure the position of your probe after the interaction is done, and if you had prepared your probe in a position eigenstate, then measuring that position of the probe will tell you something about the value of A. So if you have two probes, 1 and 2, and you put a term in your interaction Hamiltonian like this, and at the end of the day you measure the position of the first probe, you have a measurement of A on your hands. But if I write down a coupling term like this, where I translate the second probe depending on the value of a different operator, B, I would have a measurement of B, the Hermitian operator B, on my hands. And A and B might not commute. And I could, if I wanted to, put both terms in the Hamiltonian. So what happens when I do that? Quantum mechanics, you know, the old style, says that, you know, every measurement should be associated with a single Hermitian operator. But here I've got terms in the Hamiltonian that allow me to measure, in some sense, both of these operators, depending on which probe I look at. But they don't commute, so there's no basis that diagonalizes both of them. What could this possibly be? Well, when you work it out, you find that you do get a joint measurement on the system, and it's represented by a POVM. It's a noisy measurement of A simultaneously with a noisy measurement of B. So if I add enough noise to the measurement, I can get a bit of information about A and a bit of information about B, even though they don't commute. Okay, maybe one final note about POVMs is that for every set of operators you might write down that satisfy the mathematical definition, there is some way of devising a measurement apparatus which will be represented by that set of operators. And in general, it involves coupling the system to some ancilla and implementing a projective measurement on the pair of them. Interestingly, not every POVM can be obtained as a mixture of projective measurements. So that's a bit different from what we saw in the case of states. In the case of mixed states, we said, look, you can always find an ensemble of pure states that mix to that guy, and you can always find an entangled state whose reduction gives you that state. But here I'm telling you there are some POVMs that can be implemented in this, you know, couple to ancilla sort of way, but that can't be implemented as a mixture of projective measurements. So this theorem is not
straightforward to prove, and I'm not going to show you a proof here. I just thought it'd be worth mentioning, so you have that in the back of your head, that if you write down something which meets the mathematical definition of a POVM, then you're guaranteed that there is a way. It might be hard to do it, but there is a way of measuring it in the lab. Okay, so I've got about a bit more than 15 minutes left. I was considering telling you about a graphical representation of POVMs that's similar to the Bloch sphere representation of states. But I think I'm going to skip it and maybe move straight on to transformations. So let me just summarize and skip those slides. So the point is that I can update the second column here and say that the most general measurement is not represented by a projection valued measure, but a positive operator. I should say positive, not position. Positive operator valued measure. And the probabilities are given by this Born rule. Let me skip all of this. You can ask me about it if you're interested. This is nice for people who like geometric pictures of things, if you have a geometric intuition. I like thinking about pictures. So there's a way of representing POVMs by sets of vectors in this double cone, all of which sum up to identity, which is the vector here. Anyways, all right. The next topic is, what is the most general kind of transformation you can have? So this is where we started, preparations, transformations, measurements. And we said that transformations are associated with unitary maps. So we know that preparations are not always associated with vectors, and measurements are not always associated with projection valued measures. We know that we can update these to density representing POVMs. But what about these guys here? Does a unitary map describe the most general transformation? So what do you think? Good guess. So here's, again, the most obvious way of trying to get beyond the unitaries is take a box which has an input port for your quantum system and an output port. And on the inside, instead of doing a particular unitary, choose a unitary at random from some probability distribution. And then we want to know, what are the probabilities for some outcomes k of a measurement here given a preparation over there? And it's all the same story. We can say, well, let's calculate the probability for the outcome k given that the ith unitary was performed times the probability that the ith unitary was performed. We know what this guy is. It's just take rho, evolve it unitarily according to the ith unitary. So that'll take me to ui rho ui dagger. And the probability of getting outcome k is just trace of that with ek. And I weight by those probabilities. And then again, I collect everything on the inside, move pi inside, sum over I. And now I can write this in the following way. There's some map over rho. It takes rho to some new density operator on the system. And it's that map which is going to represent this box. And it's not just a single unitary. It's a mixture of those guys. So I could write it like this. The map is sum over I pi. UI, UI dagger. And you can prove that for non-trivial mixtures, no unitary can simulate this sort of action. So strictly speaking, this is a map from operators on Hilbert space to operators on Hilbert space. It's sometimes called a super operator because it takes operators to operators. So it acts sort of one level up. Let me give you another example of where a unitary might not be sufficient. And again, it's just the same story that we saw for the preparations and the measurements. You can do an evolution on the system by coupling it unitarily to another system, an Ancilla system prepared in some state, and asking, what's the overall effect of this on the evolution of the system alone? So again, we ask what it does to the statistics. So we start with rho s tensor tau a. That's our initial state. We act this unitary on the pair. So I put u dagger here. And then finally, we end with a measurement of some POVM on s. And we're ignoring a.
So that corresponds to this trivial measurement, which is just identity on A. So this is the measurement that's implemented on S and A together. And so this is just the Born rule, trace over the whole Hilbert space, the POVM for the whole Hilbert space times the state for the whole Hilbert space that comes out over here. And then, again, move the trace over A to the inside and group all the stuff that depends on A together. So that's all this stuff here. And I trace over A. And so I can just write that as some map on the state of S. And that defines what the transformation that this box implements is. And here it is. So I haven't told you much about the properties of these maps. I think that's what I do next. This particular scenario here corresponds to open system dynamics. So if the system is not isolated, right? So we said, remember in those earlier axioms, we said if your system's isolated, it evolves unitarily. Here it's not isolated, it's interacting with another system. So it's not evolving unitarily, it's undergoing this open system dynamics, which is represented by one of these maps. And this is also the scenario in decoherence. That if I have a system, say in my lab, and I'd like to keep it isolated from everything else, but unfortunately it tends to couple to systems in the background, it's hard for me to isolate it. I can always think of that as just a unitary interaction of the system in the background. Oh, thanks. So this is also describes, you know, unwanted interactions of your system with things in the background. And it prevents them from evolving unitarily as the experimentalist would want. Okay. I'm giving you one more example before I go on to tell you about the properties of these maps. Okay. So this example is a case where you just do a measurement, and the system is left over after the measurement is done, but you don't register the outcome of the measurement. Okay. So you just ignore. You put the whole thing in a box, and no. Outcome comes out of the box, so it's not itself a measurement, it's just a transformation. Okay. So we know that this measurement would act on pure states by the collapse postulate, this guy here. So it takes psi to the projection of psi into the kth eigenspace with this probability. And if I want to write that in terms of density operators, well, I just take, you know, the projector onto psi gets mapped to this beast here. I've just taken this times its bra, times its dual. Okay, so if I then say, well, how does it act on some arbitrary state rho? It's just the same. Rho goes to pi k rho pi k. Yes.
Is it really a measurement?
I'm imagining that what's inside this box is a measurement device that is associated with this set of projectors.
So we can know the results after
if we opened up the box and looked at the measurement device, we could learn the result. But I'm imagining that it doesn't come out of this box here. So, you know, you could imagine if I say, look, I have this system, I did a measurement on it of, say, spin along Z, I'm passing it back to you, but I'm not going to tell you what outcome I got. Then you have to say, well, how should I model that transformation that Rob just did? So I'm going to work out what the map corresponding to your information about the system has to be. So this is what the collapse map looks like for density operators. But if I have this sort of scenario, then really rho is being mapped to, say, pi 1 rho pi 1 normalized with probability p1, and pi 2 rho p2 with probability p2. So it's really being mapped to an ensemble of possibilities. But you don't know which, so you have to average over all these guys. So for somebody who doesn't know the outcome, rho gets mapped to a sum over k, pk, these projected versions of rho. But of course, these pks, the probability of the kth outcome, just is trace rho pi k. So I can cancel these two terms. And this is what the overall effect of this transformation is. So it's just project rho into the eigenspaces and sum over all those eigenspaces. So for example, if rho was a coherent superposition of Z-spin eigenstates, and a measurement of Z-spin is made, and you don't find out the outcome, all that comes out is now an incoherent mixture of those Z-spin eigenstates with the mod squared of the amplitudes that you originally had. So the only effect of that measurement would be to destroy the coherence between the Z-spin up state and the Z-spin down state. Good. So those are the three examples that I wanted to show you. So here's the definition of the map. See? Now let me tell you about the properties that these things have. So forgetting about these examples for a moment, you might just say, well, what properties should such a map have in order for it to be valid? What's the largest set of maps we could imagine? So the first thing that you should have is convex linearity. So if somebody says, I'm preparing a state rho I with probability wi, and you want to know, how does the map act on that? Well, it had better be satisfy the following property, that the evolute of the convex sum, so somebody who, how should somebody who doesn't know the value of I describe the evolution? That should be the same as taking the evolute of each state and summing up with the probabilities, right? Because this could just be thought of as ignorance. Really, it is one of the rho I's. You don't know which one it is. So clearly, at the end of the day, the final state should just be whatever rho I evolved to summed up with the different probabilities describing what you know. So it should satisfy that. It should preserve the trace. So if the state you put in is a valid state, then trace rho is 1. The thing that comes out of the other side of the transformation procedure should also be a valid state. So its trace should be 1. This entails that for any operator, t acting on that operator should have the same trace as the operator itself. So that's called the trace preserving property. Finally, we know that valid states in quantum mechanics correspond to positive operators. And so if I want the state that comes out to also be valid, it should be a positive operator. So t of rho has to be a positive operator. So t should be positivity preserving. But that's not quite enough, because it turns out that there are operators, what we want is that even if I prepare a state on a larger system, say S and A, this might be an entangled state between S and A, and it's this state is positive, and then I act my map on just the system, and I do nothing to the other system, well, that should also be a valid state. All we're saying here is that if you know you've got a valid state on two systems and you do the map here, then what comes out the other side should be a valid state. Now, it turns out that this is a stronger constraint than this one, because there do exist some maps which are positivity preserving but don't have this property. This property here is called complete positivity. So T is said to be completely positive if it's not just positive on the states in on the space it acts on, but it's also a positivity preserving for states on a larger Hilbert space. So an example of a map that's positive but not completely positive is the transpose operation on S. So if I took transpose on S, tensor identity on A, and I feed in an entangled state, turns out what you can get out the other side is an operator that has negative eigenvalues and therefore can't be a state. So just sort of as an aside, those maps that are positive but not completely positive are useful in the theory of entanglement. When you want to, say you have a complicated entangled state, you want to know whether it's entangled or not. If you take the partial transpose on one of the systems and you find you get a negative eigenvalue, then you know that it was entangled. Okay, so clearly you have to have all three of these properties for a map to take valid states to valid states. It turns out there's a really useful representation theorem for these kinds of maps. So incidentally, these are called completely positive trace-preserving linear maps. I didn't say it explicitly, but if something's convex linear, then you can prove it's also linear. So I can make these WIs real coefficients rather than positive coefficients if I want. And so you know, we call these things completely positive trace-preserving linear maps. It's a very elegant name. Sometimes CPTP. And the linear is usually left out. Anyhow, any map that has that property can be written in this very nice form. There's some set of operators, AK,
These aren't necessarily positive operators. They're not necessarily even Hermitian operators. They're just a set of linear operators. Okay, so that's a bit unusual. You probably haven't seen that come up in quantum mechanics before, but this is a set, any old set of linear operators. And if I write a sum over k, ak, rho, ak, dagger, and these operators satisfy this constraint here, then this map is a completely positive trace-preserving linear map. It satisfies all those properties that I just told you about. Now, that's not an easy representation theorem to prove, and I'm not going to do it here. But let me just note that all the maps we've seen, the three examples, have that form. So the easiest one to see is this non-selective measurement, the one where you do the measurement, you don't find out the outcome, that had this form, right? So in that case, the AKs are just these projections. And projections are Hermitian, so the dagger of pi k is just pi k itself. So this does have that form. And if I take pi k dagger, which is pi k, times pi k, well, these things are idempotent. So pi k squared is pi k. And I know that the sum over k pi k is identity because this was a projection-valued measure. So this guy satisfies that definition. If I look at another one of my examples, the mixture of unitaries here, well, it doesn't look quite like this yet, but I can just massage it a little bit. I take pi and break it up into square root pi here, square root pi here. So now I can call this ai, and this is ai dagger. And I haven't written it explicitly here, but if I take ai dagger times ai, so imagine taking this, moving it here, well, the ui dagger ui becomes identity. I'm just left with a pi. I sum over I get 1 times identity. So again, this property holds for this case. And then the third example, which is the case where you interact your system with another ancillary system, it has this form. And that's even less clearly of this sort. But again, you can massage it into that shape. So let me take the simplest example. Suppose the state of your ancilla was just a projection onto some vector phi. Then if I put the projection onto phi here, I can actually rewrite this by writing down my trace over A explicitly. So J is some basis for the Hilbert space on A. I can rewrite this in this form. So this term here is some operator on SA sandwiched between vectors on A. So this is some operator on S. Because J and phi are generally different, this isn't a positive or a Hermitian operator on S necessarily, but it's some operator on S. And this is just the dagger of that operator. So again, it has that form. And then finally, if you try to calculate this, you'll be able to verify that it gives you identity. So all the examples we saw do fit that form. So hopefully that sort of convinces you by induction that it's plausible that this representation theorem can be proven. So the set of transformations in quantum theory is much broader than just the set of unitaries. I should also say that, just like as we saw with the POVMs, if I give you any map that satisfies that mathematical definition, completely positive, trace preserving, and linear, then you can find a way of implementing it in the lab by coupling it to some ancillary system via unitary for some state of the ancillary system. And that's called the Steinspring dilation theorem. Again, I'm not going to prove it to you. I just thought it's useful for you to know that. Okay. I'm running out of time. I'm out of time. Let me say just use a couple more minutes of your time, and then I'll end. Turns out that a given one of these maps can be implemented in many different ways. So take this example. Here, I'm choosing to do either the identity operation or the sigma z unitary, which is just a rotation about the z-axis in the Bloch sphere by 180 degrees. Okay, so suppose that's my transformation. Choose those with equal probabilities. So this is the map. It's 1 half identity rho identities. So I've just dropped the identities here. It's 1 half rho plus 1 half u rho u dagger. But for the case of sigma z, it's Hermitian. It's a unitary and a Hermitian operator. So u dagger is just u. So that's the map. And so if I think about how this acts on the Bloch sphere, here's a Bloch sphere.
that. Suppose I have some state somewhere on the surface over here. So this map says with probability half, it undergoes the identity transformation, so it stays here. And with probability half, it gets rotated 180 degrees about the z-axis. And it goes to the antipodal point, the point on the opposite side. And so if I average these two guys, then I'm left with this guy. So all the states on the block sphere get evolved to the state that's on the z-axis at that level of the block sphere. Okay, so that's the effect. So any CP, TP map on the block sphere can be represented by telling you where the surface of the sphere goes to. In this case, the whole surface gets mapped on to this axis. So the question is, what other sort of way could you imagine implementing this map? I'll give you a hint. When the map is done, you have states that are mixtures of Z spin up and Z spin down eigenstates. They have no coherence between Z spin up and Z spin down. So what sort of transformation might get you there?
Just measure spin Z?
Yes, measure spin Z and ignore the outcome. That's this here, right? So if I have a measurement device for Z spin, but I don't register what outcome I got, well, what we saw in previous slides is that I just take, say, the first projection of 0, pi rho pi, so that's this, and the second projector, also, you know, pi 1 rho pi 1, as this form. And that's just this, which is a scalar, the probability that rho assigns to the 0 state times the 0 vector, probability rho assigns to the 1 state times the 1 projector. So this map and this map are actually identical. They've just been written in different forms here. I should have said that Krauss decomposition with the AK, AK daggers, there are many ways of writing a single map. So there are many different decompositions for a single map. Just like we saw that there are many ways of taking a mixed state, representing it as a sum of pure states, there are many ways of decomposing a POVM into a mixture of projections. Similarly, there are many ways of decomposing a completely positive map into one of these decompositions. Okay, so here's where we got to. Remember, we started with these sort of we tried to operationalize the axioms of quantum theory. And now we say that for a general preparation, it's represented by a density operator rather than a vector. General measurement is represented by a POVM. And a general transformation is represented by a trace-preserving completely positive linear map. And this is what the Born rule looks like now. You take T acting on rho, multiplied by EK, and take the trace. So this is more properly, what's going on in operational quantum theory. I can, again, lump this transformation with the preparation, takes rho to rho prime. Or I can lump this transformation with the measurement. This is kind of a Heisenberg picture for the CPTP maps. I haven't told you what the definition of this is, but I'm just going to skip it. This is the definition here. The point is that you can represent your transformations as acting on the measurements, if you like. And then what I didn't have time to tell you about is that there's something more general than the projection postulate. If I do a general measurement, like maybe associated with a POVM, and ask, how does that affect the state, rho? Well, it turns out that it's not just this projection postulate type dynamics that's possible. You could find any trace non-increasing completely positive linear map, TK, which has this property, EKs are your POVM elements. And that's a possible update rule. So that would sort of take us a little bit too far afield, but rest assured that there's many more ways of updating your state through a measurement than just the collapse postulate you're familiar with. Okay, and so this is my last slide. The point is that we can replace all those postulates that we saw before, the ones from the textbooks, with these postulates. Our objective was to eliminate the term physical state from the postulates and replace it with expressions involving what you do in the lab, like preparations and measurements and transformations. So the new postulates say that every preparation is associated with a density operator, every measurement is associated with a positive operator valued measure, And the probability of that measurement giving you the outcome k is just given by the Born rule, trace rho e k. Every transformation procedure is associated with a trace preserving completely positive linear map, which takes rho to t of rho. And finally, the one that we didn't really talk too much about, the collapse postulate is replaced with this one. For every measurement outcome k, there is a trace non-increasing completely positive linear map that evolves the state of that outcome. And so, success. We've managed to eliminate physical states from postulates, and we're only talking about measurements. So this is the minimal interpretation of quantum theory that we're going to use for the rest of the course to evaluate different interpretive schemes. And I'm sorry for going over time. So I'll see you tomorrow.